This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Tehran says the Iraqi government is responsible to prevent threats against Iran from the Kurdistan region in view of the two countries' excellent relations. Defying international outcry, Israel says it will not cooperate with any external investigation into the killing of veteran Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. And the European Union's top diplomat says the bloc has provided Ukraine with over $8 billion worth of weapons and military hardware since the war with Russia started. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. In our top story, Iran says Iraq's federal government has a responsibility to prevent threats coming from the Arab country's northern region of Kurdistan. Iran's foreign minister says that Tehran and Baghdad enjoy excellent relations, and so Tehran does not expect to be threatened from Iraqi Kurdistan region. Hossein Amir Abdullahian added, "The security of the two neighbors can be guaranteed if they abide by the outcome of bilateral talks." He made the remarks in a phone call with the Iraqi foreign minister. For his part, Fuad Hussein gave assurances that Baghdad will not allow any threats to come to its neighbors from Iraqi soil. Earlier, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps carried out a fresh drone and missile strike against terrorist bases in Iraqi Kurdistan. The force says the strikes are in response to terrorist operations against Iran. Earlier, political commentator Sam Mahdi Torabi joined us with his take on the IRGC's operation in northern Iraq.
As you said, it's not the first time, and it probably won't be the last time that it happened. The problem is that we have, within the Kurdish areas in northern Iraq, a particular group, a family, which from previous years, from decades before, has very close relations with the Mossad, with the Israelis, and with the Americans. So the point is that that region is not uniformly supporting this problem. There are other groups and other parties and other movements within that area which are opposed to the presence of the terrorists. But there is one particular group and one particular family who, from long time ago, has been a group that has allowed the presence of the Americans, the Israelis, the British before, to be in that region. And from that region, this is something that goes back to the British division of the area. They created an area in the middle between Iran, Turkey, Iraq, Syria, from where they can always destabilize these countries.
EU foreign affairs ministers have agreed new sanctions against Iranian individuals and entities during a meeting in Brussels on Monday. Jerome Hughes has your details.
Iran insists that recent riots in the country were orchestrated by outside adversaries such as the United States. But EU foreign ministers meeting in Brussels on Monday took a different view. They have agreed on new sanctions against Iran, claiming the rioters are seeking freedom.
To support them, today the Council adopted another 31 listing under the Iran human rights regime.
The channel you are watching now, Press TV, has also been added to the EU sanctions list. Press TV management has vehemently rejected claims by the EU that the channel broadcast forced confessions from detainees during recent riots in Iran. EU officials have been asked to provide evidence to back up the claims, but it's already clear that will not be forthcoming, simply because it never happened. This latest set of sanctions follows similar measures against Iran taken by the EU in October.
Iran is geographically a very strong position because they can decide, okay, if the European Union is going to make life harder in terms of sanctions, we can close or threaten to close the Strait of Hormuz. That means that Qatar, which is the principal supplier, I think about 70% of gas is coming from Qatar these days, will be stranded.
One EU minister says the new sanctions should not be allowed to derail talks around the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal.
I hope that this can be kept separated because the JCPOA negotiations, of course, it has a long history already, and I would say it's this close that we could get an agreement on JCPOA.
During a debate on human rights in the European Parliament a few days ago, the EU was accused of displaying double standards.
Europe has invaded and butchered millions, plundered and committed genocide, overthrown and murdered revolutionaries, backed brutal dictators, imposed murderous sanctions.
Amid growing economic turmoil in the EU, many experts claim sanctions against Russia have backfired. In other words, sanctions don't work. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Tehran has slammed French President Emmanuel Macron for his recent meeting with a number of anti-Iran figures. The foreign ministry spokesperson said meeting was a violation of France's international responsibilities in the fight against terrorism and violence. He called Macron's praise for a notorious anti-Iran activist shameful.
On Friday, French President Emmanuel Macron held a meeting with a number of U.S.-based anti-Iran figures at the Élysée. Among them, Masih Alinejad, who has for years led an anti-Iran campaign from the U.S. In the meeting, Macron described the recent riots in Iran as a revolution. Tehran strongly condemned the meeting, with the foreign ministry slamming it as a flagrant violation of France's international responsibilities in the fight against terrorism and violence. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani dismissed Macron's praise for an anti-Iran activist as regrettable and shameful. Kanani said it's surprising that the president of a country that advocates freedom would degrade himself by meeting a dissident who has tried to spread hatred and carry out violent and terrorist acts both inside Iran and against Iran's diplomatic missions abroad. Western media tried to portray Masih Alinejad as an activist. Reviewing Alinejad's social media posts, one would notice that much of her online activity revolves around the campaign through which she calls on her followers inside Iran to go on the streets, do something to provoke a reaction, record it, and then send the video file to her for online posting. She calls the campaign My Camera is My Weapon, a campaign hoping to achieve polarization, confrontation, and hatred in Iranian society. She's on the U.S. government payroll. Between 2015 and 2022, the U.S. Agency for Global Media paid Alinejad over $628,000 to use her show to push Iranian women into challenging Iranian laws, while also demanding more sanctions against her country. She has been living in the U.S. for the past decade, working as a full-timer for Voice of America Persian, a media outlet directly funded by the U.S. government, made to capitalize on harmful narratives in favor of Washington's interests. It is interesting but not surprising to see Alinejad being hosted in Élysée Palace by French President Macron, who supported a law in his own country to criminalize the filming and dissemination of images showing the face or other identifying characteristics of a member of the National Police, the so-called global security law, with imprisonment of up to 1 year and a fine of up to €45,000 for the offenders. The meeting with Macron was not the first of its kind. In 2019, Alinejad met Mike Pompeo, then U.S. Secretary of State, a hawkish politician with this mindset.
I was the CIA director. We lied, we cheated, we stole. It was like, we had entire training courses.
In 2018, Alinejad also joyfully met Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, whose hawkish mindset saw the U.S. sanctions killing of 500,000 Iraqi children as a price worth it.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it.
Albright died earlier this year, but the brutal imperialist mindset is still alive and kicking, with the likes of Alinejad advocating for more economic terrorism.
anti-Iran figure stated that they had called on the French president to recall the country's ambassador, expel Iranian diplomats, halt sanctions removal talks, and impose new sanctions against Tehran. The organizer of this meeting was a group called the Justice for Kurds, which has a special focus on Kurdish separatist parties in Iran, Syria, Iraq, and Turkey.
The organizer of the meeting between Ali Nejad and Macron is the New York-based Justice for Kurds group. The co-founders of this organization are Thomas S. Kaplan and Bernard Henry Levy. In Justice for Kurds, they are pursuing the goal of forming the state of Kurdistan, which is the result of the division of Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. Levy and Kaplan are both linked to the American hawkish group United Against Nuclear Iran, which pressured pharmaceutical firms to stop selling drugs to Iran amid a massive coronavirus outbreak in the country. Levy is a member, while Kaplan is one of the main funders of the group. Levy and Kaplan have lobbied for the interests of Saudi Arabia and the UAE to sanction Iran. Also, in 2019, a report revealed that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates had paid over $35 million to the UANI and its sister organization, the Counter-Extremism Project, over 2 years. In addition to Kaplan, Sheldon Adelson is one of the top donors to UANI. Reports show that Kaplan and Adelson accounted for over three-quarters of the group's total revenue for 2013. The UANI is one of the organizations that Tehran imposed sanctions on in late October for committing human rights violations, interfering in Iran's internal affairs, instigating violence and riots in the country, encouraging acts of terror, countering Tehran's moves and attempts to fight terrorism, and mounting pressure on the Iranian nation amounting to economic terrorism.
Israel says it will not cooperate with an external investigation into the killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Israeli Minister for Military Affairs made the remarks after reports the FBI has launched a probe into the killing of the Palestinian-American reporter. Benny Gantz said the inquiry amounts to interference in Israel's internal affairs and is a serious mistake. Abu Akleh was fatally shot by Israeli forces while covering a raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin back in May. Her killing sparked international outrage and calls for justice. The Israeli military initially denied responsibility for the killing, but later admitted that one of its troops had probably shot her. Investigations by the UN and several news organizations have concluded that the journalist was deliberately targeted by Israeli troops. EU top diplomat has hailed the bloc's military assistance to Ukraine in its war with Russia, while claiming that Moscow has failed in its military efforts. After a meeting of EU foreign ministers, Joseph Borrell said the bloc will continue to isolate Russia globally by imposing sanctions in order to cripple the Russian economy. He also claimed the Russian President Vladimir Putin is unable to defeat the Ukrainian army and is withdrawing his troops to compensate for what Borrell called military failures. EU foreign policy chief also accused Putin of deliberately increasing human suffering in Ukraine. Borrell further gave some figures of the European Union's aid to Ukraine since the start of the war back in late February.
And I think I can say that at least 8 billions of military equipment have already been provided to Ukraine by the European Union and the member states. It's about 45% of the effort done by the U.S. So it's not negligible. We are talking about not 3.1, but about 8 billions of military support.
Canada has also announced it's doubling its military aid to Ukraine to over $1 billion Canadian dollars. Funds go toward military surveillance, communications equipment, fuel, and medical supplies. This as the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau sanctioned Russian justice and security officials. Bans target Russian police, investigators, and other officials who Canada accuses of human rights violations against opposition leaders. Meanwhile, Russia adds another 100 more Canadians to its sanctions list in the latest chapter of tit-for-tat measures between the two countries. Following Canada's sanctions back in October, the Russian Foreign Ministry announced the banning of 100 people it deems directly involved in the formation of an aggressive anti-Russian policy. They include Canadian officials, business leaders, and media personalities. Canada has so far sanctioned over 1,400 Russian individuals and entities since the start of the Ukraine war. Hundreds of medical workers take to the streets in Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires, to protest against low salaries and poor working conditions.
I feel sad. The truth is that they take away our vocation because we can no longer work like this and live like this with an undignified job. We have a great vocation. We do it non-stop for the patients. We love public health, but people have to know because they will always go to the hospital. No matter what coverage they have, they will always need the hospital.
Doctors and nurses held candles and carried banners that read, "Healthcare does not switch off." Protest comes almost 3 weeks after health workers began a push for an increase in their minimum wage, among other demands. A freeze in wages and rampant inflation has put pressure on staff in 30 public hospitals throughout Buenos Aires. Inflation is forecast to log a 100% surge this year in Argentina. In Australia, hundreds of people have been rescued after flash floods hit several towns in the country's southeast. Rescuers have used helicopters to save people trapped on the rooftops in the worst-hit towns in the state of New South Wales. Residents scrambled to rooftops to flee the floods caused by heavy downpours in recent days. Water has inundated homes, highways, bridges, and farms, and isolated many towns. Despite the halt in raining, emergency crews are warning the danger is yet to pass. Over the past year, Australia's east coast has been repeatedly struck with severe floods driven by La Nina phenomenon, which brings heavy rains. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we said that Imam Khomeini returned to Tehran from the holy city of Qom after 10 months due to his health conditions. Today we are going to discuss the events related to the outbreak of the 8-year war which was imposed by the U.S. through its stooge, Saddam Hussein, the former dictator of Iraq. Stay tuned for more. After a few months of adventurism on the borderlines, the Ba'athist regime of Saddam in Baghdad started the military invasion of Iran on September 22, 1980. The war began with the bombardment of Iran's airports. Saddam hoped that the Islamic Republic of Iran could not resist the invasion and would soon collapse. The fact of the matter is that the 8-year war was imposed on Iran due to the fear of the U.S. and its allies from the spread of the Islamic Revolution to other Islamic countries. As Saddam was dreaming of leadership of the Arab world, he managed to unite almost all of the Arab regimes in one front against the threat of the non-Arab Iran. Thus, on September 22, 1980, Saddam ordered that 192 bombers and fighters should target Iran's major airports. In the afternoon, the Iraqi Air Force attacked the airports of Mehrabad in Tehran, Nojeh in Hamedan, and the airports of Tabriz, Sanandaj, Isfahan, Kermanshah, and some other cities. Simultaneously, the Iraqi ground force started invading Iran's soil on three fronts with three corps. Although the Iranian people were first feared of the Saddam attacks, in many of the border areas, people spontaneously hindered the advancement of the Iraqi army with little equipment and ammunition. Meanwhile, many of these people were forced to leave their homes and hearths. Moreover, the Islamic Republic Air Force shot down five Iraqi aircrafts on the first day of the invasion. Imam Khomeini's representative in the army, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, announced on TV, "The hired and mercenary Iraqi government has started the aerial invasion of the Islamic Republic of Iran's border and attacked several air bases. We had not intended to attack so far, but the Islamic Republic army does not tolerate the invasion of these Ba'athist stooges and will give a bitter lesson to Saddam." The Iranian Air Force attacked the Iraqi bases of Ar-Rashid and Shu'aibiyah of Iraq just 2 hours after the Iraqi invasion. The next day, the Iranian brave pilots targeted the air bases and communication and radar centers of the Iraqi Air Force with 140 bombers. Iran continued crushing air raids for another 2 days, which forced the Ba'athist army to transfer many of its aircrafts to Al-Walid Air Base near the Jordanian border to be out of the range of the Iranian fighters. However, the Iranian reconnaissance aircrafts chased them, and the Iranian pilots successfully operated the aerial fueling and reached Al-Walid Air Base to destroy many Iraqi fighters and bombers. The operation was called H-3 and was registered as an honor in the history of the Iranian army. Although the Iraqi invasion was a shock to the Iranian nation and government, they were soon united behind Imam Khomeini and stiffly resisted the Iraqi criminal army with high morale. The officials in those days all spoke of the Imam's firm belief and his certainty of victory over Saddam and his invading army. On the first day of the war, Imam Khomeini said about Saddam's invasion, "Nothing has happened. Just a crazy man has thrown a stone." This showed his strong faith in God and godly promises. At the same time, he humiliated Saddam. Elsewhere in his remarks, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, said, "We will resist, even if this war continues for 20 years. In those tough conditions, Imam Khomeini was so calm, as if nothing had happened. The Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, said, "I really hate war, and I am worried that how many dear ones will be lost. But I believe in the leadership of the Imam. I am sure that he will keep the country safe against the evil of Saddam. You too, don't worry." Imam Khomeini issued a message to the Iranian nation at 7 o'clock that day. In the message, the Imam asked the people to resist steadfastly against the Iraqi invasion.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the relations between the U.S. and China, the number one and two economies in the world, it is said to be the worst in decades. During the G20 summit, when the two met, U.S. President Joe Biden warned President Xi Jinping on a host of issues like North Korea and Taiwan. Can the two manage their differences to prevent competition from becoming conflict, as the IMF has warned? Or is it inevitable that the two are on a collision course? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Daniel Lazar, journalist and author, joins us from New York. Also joining us is Mahmoud Rafat. He's the president at the European Institute for International Law, who joins us from Stockholm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Daniel Lazar, I will first start with you, taking a look at the relations between the U.S. and China. I've broken it down into some of the core issues that seems to be the ones that they are experiencing major differences in. We're talking about Hong Kong, for example, or Taiwan, the South China Sea, trade practices, and U.S. restrictions on Chinese technology. Is it accurate to say that those are the top, what is it, four or five issues that they have major differences on?
Yes, and you could also throw in Xinjiang and Tibet as well, where the U.S. has backed various kinds of pro-independence forces. But sure, those are the key issues.
Okay. So setting that stage, Mahmoud Rafat, what are we looking at when it comes to an issue like North Korea, when the U.S. President Joe Biden actually issued a warning to Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, that it would enhance the security positions in Asia? That was the warning, if Beijing cannot rein in North Korea's weapons program. I mean, doesn't that, in a sense, imply that China can pull the strings when it comes to North Korea and its weapons program?
Well, let's say United States one treats China. Doesn't treat one level in China. China is a full package, which has economic interest from one side, represented in the cheap labor, represented in the big markets, more than 1.5 billion, etc. But at the same time, it has thrones to United States, and it has some difficulties in United States, some challenges, like Taiwan level, like North Korean level. That's why it takes it, or it should be taken as a package from any administration, this administration or another administration. Maybe the unique exception was the President Trump administration. And
okay,
President
so when
Trump
you say it has to be taken as a package, you mean that North Korea then is part of a package when it comes to China?
It's a part of the Chinese package because it represents a real and serious and critical challenge to threat, I mean, to the United States. And so this is the most.
So when North Korea fires its missiles, is it doing on its own, or is it taking orders from China, do you think?
Well, China has big harmony, if we can say it like that, with North Korea. That's sure. It has a strong relationship since long time, since decades, since the father of actual president, not only from today. So it has a warm and somehow upper hand, if we can call it like that, mm-hmm. in the decisive situations, it can stop North Korean threats to
United
States.
Do you agree with that? Do you agree with that, Daniel Azar, that China has that much influence over North Korea to the point that it can just tell North Korea, stop your missile test? Or are we looking at the fact that the U.S.'s point of view, at least that's what the U.S. president is saying. He issued a warning. That's how it was reported. Stop North Korea's weapons program. I mean, does China have that much influence?
No, I think the U.S. exaggerates China's influence over North Korea. I mean, yes, I mean, China has had basically, strong relations with North Korea since over the last 70 years. But North Korea itself is a very independent-minded country. Doesn't take orders from Beijing or anyone else. So therefore, I mean, I think China has influence, but that influence is less than decisive. I think the U.S. is being very aggressive in accusing China of somehow being responsible for North Korea's missile program. And of course, that can't help but raise hackles on the part of the Chinese.
Very curious as to why Mahmoud Rafat, since we're talking about North Korea, and then we're going to move on from that, why they don't talk about U.S. sanctions. I mean, U.S. sanctions are killing North Koreans, literally. They don't have much trade going on, and you can tell by the state of, I'm not too sure what sector it's not affecting. I mean, why isn't that mentioned when you issue a threat when it comes to U.S. To China on the North Korea issue?
Well, before I go to the sanctions, because unfortunately these sanctions killed also Iraqi people in the past, not in the very long past, let me just clarify something very important. When I say China has big influence on North Korea, is to break down its threat to United States, not to stop completely its missiles program, because that's impossible, because this is the unique legitimacy for the regime there, as well as the unique protection for North Korea, according to the thinking or way of thinking of the North Korean regime. So not the program, but about the threat itself. Well, concerning sanctions, let me say to you, because I'm author of book, can be found on Google, Economic Sanctions Between International Law and Practice. Unfortunately, the practice of applying and application of sanctions and economic sanctions is violating severely the international law. And that we have been witnessing in lots of cases in Iraq and somehow in Yemen as well today by the coalition of Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates backed by UK and United States. And that's literally harvesting lives of Yemeni Tigray by the regime of Abiy Ahmed, which is backed also by the West, etc. So there is big violation. The international law for international law, for economic sanctions, not only North Korean.
Sure.
Unfortunately, it's like that.
Okay. Now, moving on to Taiwan, pretty clear where the stance is there from both, I think, Daniel Lazar, when you have China saying that that's a red line, and then the U.S., well, they have done what they've done, whether it's military supplies, whether it's sending high-ranking officials there. And Xi has been very clear. And let me see if I can pull out a quote here where he has said, anyone that seeks to split Taiwan from China will be violating the fundamental interests of the Chinese nation, and ultimately saying that it's a red line. How can there be any kind of resolve there? The Chinese stance is clear. We know what the U.S. thinks. And also at the same time, let it be known, or we should bring into the conversation, that Joe Biden, even though they said that they've cleared up the issue, has said on numerous occasions now, we can say, that it will come to defend Taiwan were it to be attacked militarily. So, you know, if you can clarify that for us.
Yeah, Joe Biden has vowed to defend Taiwan militarily on at least four different occasions. So that's pretty strong. America is the global hegemon. It is the most powerful country on earth, and it also has gotten used to running global affairs according to its own interests. And so the U.S. sees the rise of a powerful China, which is in a position to challenge U.S. hegemony, as really a kind of life and death issue. So the U.S. is determined to put China in its place. And that means taking a very strong stance on Taiwan and navigation of the South China Sea, and also engaging in militarily ever more confrontational policies. What this leads to is impossible to predict, but it seems that a military clash of some kind seems to be ultimately unavoidable. We can't say when, we can't say how, no one knows the answer. But in a case like this, it seems the U.S. will do whatever it has in its power to put China in its place. And I think that essentially requires, from a U.S. point of view, a Russian solution. In other words, just as the demise of the Soviet Union led to the rise of Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s and a full decade of economic ruin for Russia, I think that what the U.S. ultimately wants is a similar denouement, it's a similar chain of events for China, in which the Chinese communist power is overthrown, a pro-capitalist government is installed, that will undoubtedly be followed by years of decay, corruption, economic setbacks, et cetera, but the U.S. essentially wants to cut China down to size.
Okay, well, they have a number of issues that perhaps they can get to that, if you agree, Mahmoud Rafat. We talked about North Korea. We briefly talked about Taiwan, which is one of the major issues at this point. Because of lack of time, we have to move on to the other issues. So I'm going to go and talk and ask you about the trade practices that the U.S. has raised with Beijing. It was done under the former U.S. president and many other ones before that, where they have, in this case in point, labeled it as non-market economic practices. What are China's non-market economic practices that the U.S. is talking about?
Well, the biggest problem of United States with China on this level or on this scope, I think it's resumed by the former president of former director of CIA the time of President Trump, when he wrote an article, I remember, in Washington Post, if I remember, or New York Times, sorry, New York Times, and he detailed the essential problems with China on the trade level. Chinese are accused by Americans, they steal the developed technology of Americans and the West in general, but American in particular, and then they resell it for cheap prices. That's why there are big loss for American companies. Number two, stealing this technology as threatening or big threat to the United States in general, not only on the economic level, but also on the national security level. And that's the big concern of the conservative side of the American politician. While the Democratic side, they are not so much scared of China in this level. In my opinion, this is a reason to Americans to be scared of, because that represents a real threat to their national security, not only to their economy, because the economy, the United States, still the pressure of the U.S. dollar.
Let's try to get an idea about, because you used the word steel there, Ahmed Rafat, and I'm wondering, Daniel Lazar, what the deal is when it comes to the technology aspect that that word is used. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but in order for major corporations, companies, or businesses from the U.S. to have access to the Chinese market, one of the prerequisites is that they need to share that technology. In exchange, they will have access to that huge market that China offers them, hence equals profits for them. Or is that not true? Because if it's sharing, then it can't be called stealing.
Yeah. No, I think you're correct. I mean, I think that, of course, disputes break out, as they inevitably do, in which the U.S. accuses China of actually, you know, misappropriating technology in a way that is contrary to the rules. And I can't, China very well, you know, may be guilty at times of that, just as the U.S. is guilty at other times. It's worth bearing in mind that the global market is structured in America's favor, so a rising young power like China really has to fight an uphill battle against U.S. hegemony. But there's a, my colleague referred to two areas of friction of in terms of U.S. economic policy. But there's a third area, which is actually in many ways more important, and it's extremely ironic that the U.S. accuses China of using its socialist industrial policy in a way to allocate investment, resources, et cetera, in a way that is unfair to the Americans. In other words, the Americans blame Chinese socialism because it's too effective in terms of global economic competition. That's extremely ironic, because the America always insisted that socialism was actually inefficient and was ruining
The U.S. says it likes competition, though. Isn't that what Biden said? We'd like the competition. So
Of course. But everyone likes competition as long as they're winning. And no one likes competition when they're losing. And so the U.S., you know, which is desperate to safeguard its international position, dislikes competition when it tends to undermine American hegemony.
Well, that's the whole thing, isn't it? Mahmoud Rafat, isn't that the whole point here? I mean, we may laugh about that, but when the U.S. can't U.S. can't get its way, even if it invites competition, then it goes about it, with what occurred just recently, right before that big conference where Xi Jinping, grip on power got extended, the U.S. Dropped the hammer, the chip technology, in which it restricted that technology to China. And it said the goal was to actually prevent China from it, because chips are used in so many different arenas, but one of the biggest ones, to prevent China from militarily advancing. And also, it would undermine China's ability to import or manufacture and export the semiconductors that run the world. So it goes and it actually does that. Is that called fair competition?
Well, let me call attention of my dear colleague, Daniel. This socialism, and let me start from there, this socialism, political policies in China, which assure and guarantee for the American industry the cheap labor, and makes the huge structures like Apple and other structures like Tesla, etc., are functioning properly, because in the United States or here in Europe, we would not be able to afford the labor of these people, because there is no the Chinese socialism. I'm not defending on any policy. I'm just focusing on and putting the light on something. Well, back to this question. Let me tell you, the caps is the main point, is the real point. Whatever, in any direction we will go through, it will not be the real direction if we do not take in consideration the caps when it comes to Taiwan. Without the chips, and without the big industry of chips, which is the biggest in the world now, and the big experience, etc. Despite it's a big chain of supplies, but at the end, these chain of supplies from the chips are gathered or centralized inside Taiwan. So this is the importance of Taiwan. Otherwise, Taiwan would not have that importance to the United States. It would not have, because, well, if we go to the practical area and we leave the slogans of democracy, of supporting democracy, of supporting rights of people, of independence, etc., because all these speech we discover last 30 or 40 decades are slogans. At the real time, the American administration is administration who's handling a nation. They have their own interests. They need their own interests. That's why they get back to any other consideration. Look how they are supporting dictator regimes of the Middle East today, and they are protecting them and feeding them, and not good only protecting there. Them.
Sure, yeah. That's
a
good point.
It's not a question of slogans. So it's the chips. It's the chips. The chips is the main key word of all the story with Taiwan.
Indeed. Now, you know, we talk about all the differences at this point. Daniel Lazar, I began this program with some of the core issues, which you agreed. And then we come to this revelation, which I would think it should be like major headline news, where it says the U.S. is working to reduce tensions behind the scenes, both Beijing and Washington, over the past, and this is what is an eye-opener, 2 months. 2 months to repair relations. So go figure. I mean, they're working behind the scenes. So I don't get it. So you have Nancy Pelosi and a whole host of other, not hosts, but a number of high-ranking U.S. officials or lawmakers that were visiting Taiwan. You have the tensions that are going on. You have the provocations, et cetera. But yet in the past 2 months, they've been working behind the scenes to mend relations. How do you read that news?
I'm very skeptical. I mean, I think, Biden doesn't want a military, conflict. He wants to keep things under control. He wants to make sure that communications go back and forth. But still, the U.S. posture is a very hard-line one. The U.S. essentially is trying to roll back Chinese power, to extend American clout, into Chinese territorial waters. And listen, the big prize will occur in Russia, which if the war in the Ukraine continues to go badly for Moscow, Vladimir Putin could conceivably fall from power. And if that happens, all of Central Asia will be in play, and the U.S. will use that in order to apply pressure on China from China's west. So the U.S. essentially will be in a position to squeeze China from both sides, from the Pacific side and from the Central Asian side. This is the great game that various U.S. foreign policy theorists have outlined over the years. It's the ultimate U.S. goal. And essentially the goal is to squeeze China until China finally breaks.
Mm-hmm. Well, to use the Russia chip, how likely do you think, Mahmoud Rafat, that is going to happen? And, for the U.S. to, militarily, to try to defeat through, of course, Zelensky and its military, Russia, in order to wean Russia away, or China away from Russia, in order to have that split occur. I mean, is that realistic, do you think?
Well, in my opinion, United States will not enter in any confrontation for the coming decade. I mean, military confrontation, neither with the Russian side nor with the Chinese side, in my opinion. And that was resumed by the former chief of the CIA in one of his, the former chief of CIA, the former chief of the army, the general of the staff of the army, which was leaked that he warned his Chinese counterpart last few days of the mandate of President Trump, when he said to his Chinese counterpart, if we are ordered by President Trump to hit you at any time, I will let you know before we do that, and we will do our best to throw our missiles in empty areas.
Okay.
That means the military officials, which I want to go through, this military officials in the United States and strategic thinkers of the United States are very, very aware that the United States is not in the position today, after what happened in the Middle East last two decades, is not in the position, and Afghanistan for sure last year, not in the position at all to enter in any military confrontation against anyone. Today, the Russian situation is too early,
right,
because we do not know who is the winner.
I'm so sorry, I got to jump in because we're fresh out of time, Mahmoud Rafat. I do apologize. I wish we had more time on this. But thank you very much. That was Mahmoud Rafat, president of the European Institute for International Law. And Daniel Lazar, thank you so much, journalist and author from New York. With that, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batahway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, for today's discussion, we want to discuss about the meaning of the first verse or ayah of Surah Al-Qamar, the fragment of which talks about when shaqqa al-qamar, a split of the moon. Was the moon really split? We can say. And does this ayah of the Quran refer to a fact, historical fact, or no, it was only a story?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, in the beginning verses of chapter Al-Qamar, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. اقتربت الساعة وانشق القمر. The hour has drawn near, referring to the day of judgment, and the moon is split. وأيّر آية يعرض ويقول سحر مستمر. If they see a sign, they turn away and say an incessant magic. So the second part of the verse, or rather the second verse, is referring to the fact that this is a called of ayah, sign, and the people call it a magic.
Yes.
So it is very explicitly referring to the fact that, so the first part of the verse, or the verse one, is referring to a miracle of the Prophet.
Yes.
That is why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala calls it an ayah, a sign, and the claim of the polytheists that yes. It is a magic. So this is one indication from the verse itself. But more important than that, there are many narrations, both narrated by Shia and Sunni scholars, according to which this is referring to one of the miracles done by the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. Many scholars, they have quoted this story, like in historical sources,
yes.
like Al-Bidayah wal-Nahaya, Al-Fitan, Al-Kharaij wal-Jara'ih, Imta'u al-Asma, these are some of the Sunni sources.
Sorry, what does it mean? I mean, when the people witnessed the moon was cut into halves, and it was witnessable, you know, observable
yeah.
easily?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. It was visible by the people.
Uh-huh.
This had been quoted in Sunni sources through six companions of the Prophet, Anas ibn Malik, Jubair, Hudhayfah ibn Yaman, Ibn Abbas, Abdullah ibn Umar, and Ibn Mas'ud. In Shia sources, we have at least two narrations by Sheikh Saduq in Al-Amali and in Tafsir Qummi. And according to many scholars, it happened at the early years of the mission of the Prophet in the city of Mecca. And according to one historical report, it happened in the fifth year before Hijrah, on the 14th of Dhul-Hijjah.
Was it a reaction or an answer to a doubt by the infidels or unbelievers
yeah,
at that time?
Yeah,
or no, it was only a miracle?
Thank you for this question. The reason that the Holy Prophet performed this miracle was that because the polytheists of the city of Mecca, they witnessed many miracles of the Prophet, but they did not believe him.
Okay.
And some of them, they claimed that they called those events as magics. And some of them claim that, okay, the Holy Prophet is only able to practice magic on earth, on the phenomena on the earth. So he's not able to do a supernatural deed on in the heaven, for example. That is why they requested the Holy Prophet to split the moon,
yes.
and the Holy Prophet did so. So there is a kind of ijma or consensus among all Shia and Sunni scholars regarding this. And there is only few people, especially among Sunni scholars. Three names are important here: Hassan Basri, Atta Khurasani, and Balkhi, who believe that no, when Shaq al-Qamar is referring to the Day of Judgment, it will happen at that time. But
mm-hmm.
this is somehow a rare opinion among even Sunni scholars.
And did it take place only once?
Yes.
Or no, it was, for example, for several times?
No, according to the narrations that we have received, it was asked by the polytheists of Mecca
uh-huh.
once, and the Holy Prophet did it once,
okay.
and then, I mean, it wasn't for a couple of hours, it was only maybe for a moment, and then, the two sides joined again.
Okay.
But it showed the fact that the Holy Prophet is a messenger from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and
right.
of course, those people who didn't want to accept the Prophet continue to do so.
Of course, in the prophetic history, this is not the first time that something is split into two. Prophet Moses has also split the ocean into
exactly.
two parts, okay?
Yeah.
This has been also claimed in the Holy Quran, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is story. Okay.
Thank you for raising this point, because now the question is that, is it scientifically
mm-hmm.
speaking
approval.
Possible
yes.
for to split the moon into two parts? And I've seen some scholars who have claimed that, okay, if it has happened, it should have been seen by all the people all around the world, and it should have been written in the books, and so on and so forth. But the point is that, first of all, we are talking about miracles. And miracle is referring, I mean, the nature of a miracle is that action is supernatural. And it's against the laws that we are familiar with. So the staff of Moses, which split the sea into two parts, is against the laws that we are familiar with. Although some people have tried to justify that miracle in an ordinary way, but this is not accepted. So at the end of the day, if we believe in the prophets and if we believe that they can do some supernatural deeds through the permission of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, so the conclusion is that there are some, maybe hidden laws of this world. We are not claiming that the miracles are rejecting the laws. No, there might be some laws that we are not aware of. So for each miracle, it's not necessary for us to find a scientific justification in a way that